This recording is a production of Faith Builders Educational Programs. This presentation was recorded at Teachers Week 2021, held at Faith Builders from August 2 through 6.
I heard the story told of a farmer who was asked what he would do if he won $1 million. He paused a little bit, thought, and he said, "Well, I'd probably farm until it was all gone." That's how I feel about teaching. If I won $1 million, I would probably teach until it was all gone. Teach for free if I could. I love teaching. Teaching is a wonderful occupation. And I hope I share that attitude toward teaching with at least most of you, if not all of you. I love getting paid to do what I love doing. Most mornings I get up and I go to school and I can't believe I'm getting paid to learn more. I'm getting paid to spend time with young people. I'm getting paid to learn about God's world and get others excited about learning about God's world. I love watching young people maturing over the years that I have them as students. I love getting to work with staff who have similar goals as mine. I love the task of teaching. But just as farmers have tasks such as hauling manure that aren't fun, so teachers have things that are not fun as well. For me, it's grading. I hate grading, I'll confess. Sometimes, though, I find myself needing to teach something I'm not really that interested in. I have to somehow get excited about, who knows, I'm not going to name things. I'll offend somebody, I'm sure. Sometimes I'd rather be somewhere else than at school. Sometimes I get tired of people. Sometimes it's specific people, sometimes it's just people in general. I love being a teacher, but there are times when being a teacher is not easy. And I'll tell you, the thing that consistently makes teaching hard for me is when students respond in, shall we say, unhelpful ways. When I've poured my heart and soul into something and the class responds, meh. When I share with them my wisdom and they do exactly the opposite of what I advise. When it feels as though the thing that I have poured my effort into is not being appreciated. When the students don't appreciate how wonderful I am, that's when I start to look at other pastures and notice how green those pastures are and start to think about what else I could be doing besides this. So, I love teaching, but sometimes my students respond in ways that make me love teaching less. That's the inspiration for these talks. For a little bit more context, I'll just admit that I came up with this topic in February. I thought with experienced teachers you would at least recognize that month. So, it's a wonderful and it's a sacred task, but our students don't always respond in wonderful and sacred ways. So, I want to give a little bit more context for the week as a whole. Before I dive into the specific topic for today. First, a few background pieces of information, or pieces of information, you all know this. Some background assumptions that I have about students. First of all, students are made in God's image. They are humans, they are made in God's image. We get that from the first chapter of Scripture, and we see that throughout Scripture. Our students are made in God's image. But we also get from the third chapter that our students are fallen. And so we have these two things. Students are made in God's image, but they're fallen. They're not going to be perfect. We should not be surprised when they sometimes mislay their halos. God, though, is working to redeem the students to himself. And we as teachers get to participate in that process. Part of what we are doing as teachers is working with God in redeeming students. Now, that's not to limit the salvation process or anything like that, but we get to help lead students toward God. So that's a background assumption that I have about students. Now, it's also true that I am made in God's image, that I am fallen, and that God is working to redeem me as well. And sometimes He uses my students in that process. So that's first thing. Second thing is I want to just give you a little bit of an outline of how I intend to approach each of these talks. So we have four sessions. In each session, I'm going to be discussing a specific response that students have that take the wind out of our sails, things that students do or say that make it not so fun to teach anymore. And so we'll be addressing one in each session. After I introduce the thing, I'm going to take a little bit of time to just look at the question. We're going to dwell with the question a little bit and think about what might be behind the scenes, what's going on inside the student when they're doing this. But then I'm going to take a little bit of a different approach. Rather than a frontal assault on this response, I'm going to take a roundabout way. I'm going to contend that in each of these cases, in the case when a student says, for example, or asks, when will I ever use this, there's actually a character issue going on in the student, and that we now have an opportunity to work on their character. So that the inspiration for that came from this book, Virtuous Minds, by Philip Dow. I just confirmed, shameless commercial plug here, I just confirmed a few minutes ago that the bookstore is carrying this book, and it's a worthwhile read. So Virtuous Minds is a book about intellectual character development. So that's going to be the approach I take each time. I will try to give a few tools for developing that character, but I'm not going to give specific answers for how will I ever use this. There's way too broad a range of subjects in which that question comes up. I can't give specific answers, but I will try to give a few tools for developing a specific character trait. So I'm going to try to identify a character trait that will help us avoid students asking these questions or responding in these ways. Now, what do I mean by character? Character is not ability. It is not the case that our students cannot act in good ways. It's that they choose not to. David Perkins says it this way: character concerns not what people are able to do as such, but how they invest their efforts within the scope of what they are able to do. So they have this range of possible behaviors, and character has to do with where they fall within that range. Now, here's how this is important for us. A first grader is going to act differently from a 12th grader. And the range of possible behaviors that you might expect out of a first grader is going to be different from that range in a 12th grader. And so we have to recognize that character is something that grows along with ability. Or I should say the expectations of character grow along with ability. So character then is a habit. It's a habit of behavior. It's a pattern of behavior. It's a pattern, too, of thinking. How students approach their subjects of study. It's also a habit of interaction. Interaction with the subject of study, interaction with each other as students, interaction with their authorities as teachers. So character involves habits. And my goal is in every session to give some thought toward how we might develop high character habits in our students. Now, I recognize this is going to be a difficult task because I think that I have at least a few kindergarten teachers in here, and I have at least a few high school teachers in here. I mean, I know I'm a high school teacher, so we have a wide range. I am a high school teacher. I'm hoping to give at least some tools for those of you who teach younger students, but I'm just going to admit up front that you may have to do some translation yourselves. So, with that background, let's dive in. I've just finished teaching a lesson in trigonometry, a lesson on proving identities, and I've led the students through some really intricate steps. These involved some non-obvious substitutions, like, for example, replacing negative cos squared theta with sine squared theta minus 1, and we get done, and I show that the one equals the other, and now it's the student's turn to practice. Mr. Coons, why do we have to learn this? When am I ever going to use this again? My dad doesn't even know this. And he's successful. What? It's fun. It's a puzzle. Don't you see? This is great. In that moment, every single response I can think of is going to be completely unhelpful. Because guess what? Once they walk out of those doors of the classroom, unless they go to teach it to somebody else or unless they go to college, they're never going to have to do this again. That's the fact. Okay? So, here's the question. How do I respond? Several things I think about that might be going on in the mind of the student when they see this. First, let's just take kind of the surface level of this. So, it looks as though what the student is saying is that everything that is worthwhile is useful. That's an assumption that it looks like the student is making. Now, I'm going to contend in just a moment that they don't actually believe that, but let's just think about that assumption for a few moments and recognize that most of the best things in life are not useful. Your friendships are not that useful. If your friendships are useful, you're using your friends and they don't really like that very well. Most of the most important things in life are not useful in the sense of making more money, becoming more better self-actualized, and so on. Okay. Maybe what the student is saying is, I don't see anything valuable in this material. And certainly one of the things they might be saying is that they know what is going to be useful in their future. Now, I've tried using this line. It doesn't work. I know so-and-so who studied this and didn't think it was going to be useful, but later in life they found that they were really glad they knew it. Okay. None of that really connects with my students. Okay. So on the surface, it looks as though students are saying that what is useful, what is worthwhile must be useful. Okay. Now, let's just recognize that they don't actually believe that. Because the number one answer that students give when you ask them what's your favorite subject at school is recess and lunch. Lunch is useful, it, you know, gives you sustenance, right? But recess is not useful, okay? Think too about how many people, when you're sitting in an airport, how many people are sitting there doing a Sudoku? Not useful, okay? So I don't think students actually believe that the only things that are worthwhile are the useful things. Here's what I do think is going on. Well, sometimes what's going on is that students are confused at this moment. In the book, How I Wish I'd Taught Maths, now forgot to put the author's name in my notes. The author puts it this way. I've never had a student ask me that question when they've just gotten loads of questions correct. They always ask it after they've gotten stuff wrong. So when I hear a student asking me, when am I ever going to use this? I don't tell them this, but what I'm hearing is, I'm confused right now as a student. Going back to the example I gave at the beginning, I had great fun walking through this, but guess what? I lost my students somewhere along the way, and they weren't having fun anymore. So that is something for us to recognize when a student asks this question. What I hear when a student asks me, why do I need to learn this? When will I use this? Is I hear them saying, I'm confused right now, and I'm also not being stimulated. We'll get back to the I'm not being stimulated in a moment. I take it as a call for myself to be clearer in my instruction, to be more inviting in my approach. In math class, I should be, rather than teaching math class as a series of rules to follow, I should be teaching it as a set of tools to solve problems. History shouldn't be a list of dates and people to memorize. History teaches us about the human condition. There are people and dates involved, definitely. But history teaches us about the human condition. We can learn for our times from history. Science also is not just a list of arcane facts to memorize. Science shows us who God is. Science reveals God in ways that we don't get otherwise. So, it is possible that we set ourselves up for this response by not teaching well. However, at the same time, I would argue that there is an opportunity for growth in the intellectual character of a student who asks that question. So while we bear some responsibility, we bear a lot of responsibility to teach as well as we possibly can. We ought also to recognize when a student asks this question, they have not fully developed the intellectual character trait of curiosity. Curiosity is innate in young children. I have 4 children. My youngest is 9 months old. She's sitting in the back, and she's exploring the world right now. She has a bottle in her hand, and she shakes it. She has a nook in her mouth, so she's not going to like stick the bottle in her mouth, but she would if the pacifier weren't there. She takes things and she drops them. She gets into things all the time. She is curious about the world. Everything that happens around her, she's there. She's observing. Curiosity is innate in young children, but somewhere along the way, we tend to lose the development of curiosity. Schools get blamed unfairly for this, but I mean, we'll get back to that as well. Curiosity, the way I'm going to define it, is that it is an earnest desire to know the truth. It's a habit of asking why often enough that you get to the real meat of the thing. Not accepting the simple answers, the simplistic and shallow answers that do not lead to any growth. It's the habit of asking why. Not the why do I have to learn this kind of question, which is removing my responsibility to do anything further. It's why. Do trees lose their leaves in the fall? Why don't pine trees lose their leaves in the fall? And so on. Why? Curiosity is noticing the interesting and puzzling, both in the everyday experiences of life and in what's unexpected. Curiosity is a habit of life that approaches the world around us as an interesting place, something worth studying. Getting into that habit of asking why can peel back the layers and reveal the richness and complexity of life. How much more is there beyond the surface? Now, I hasten to say, though, that curiosity is not an end in itself. Curiosity is going to be the engine that drives a lot of other development, but curiosity in and of itself is not a good thing. There is such a thing as bad curiosity. Adam and Eve wondered what would happen if they ate that fruit. Curiosity can be really destructive. But curiosity aimed at noble causes, curiosity aimed at bettering the human condition, curiosity aimed at learning more about God, curiosity that leads us higher and forward is curiosity that drives learning forward. So, some have called curiosity the central of the intellectual habits, of the intellectual character traits. So how do we develop curiosity? What do we do to make our students curious? Here, kindergarten teachers have an advantage. Their students haven't lost it yet. And your job is just don't kill it. There's more than that, but one of the things I'm going to develop as a theme, or I'm just going to come back to again and again, as we talk about the different intellectual character traits that we want to develop in our students, one of the things that I'm going to say again and again is that if we want our students to have this, we need to model it ourselves. I think it's Howard Hendricks who said, if you want your students to bleed, you have to hemorrhage. So if you want your students to be curious, perhaps maybe being curious yourself is a good place to start. Just getting into the habit of asking why often enough that you really get into some interesting things is a good habit to develop personally. Now, what do we do? I said earlier that one of the things we need to do is to stop killing curiosity. And the best way to kill curiosity in students is to spoon-feed them everything they need to know. I am the source of knowledge. You are the receptacles of my knowledge. I'm going to pour my knowledge into your heads, and then you will have everything you need. That does not invite students to become involved in their own learning in any way. I think it's, well, the quote is attributed to Einstein, but Einstein said a lot of things he didn't actually say. The quote is, it's a miracle that curiosity survives formal education. And that's kind of a cutting quote, really. But if our formal education is this spoon-feeding of everything the students need, then what we're going to do eventually is we're going to kill all of their curiosity. So, what do we do instead of this spoon feeding? One of the things that we can start very young and should continue all the way into 12th grade is to invite our students to observe. Take a kindergarten class, give them a flower, and ask them to observe it. Just say what they see. Take a third grade class, give them a complex picture, and ask them, what do you see? Take a high school science class, run a chemical reaction and ask them, what do you see? This is going to take time. This takes away from the time that I want to be pouring knowledge into their heads. But it's valuable because it starts that process of observing. Observing starts that process of asking why. Ask the question, what stood out to you? And then give time. Just give some time for students to observe. And then cut it off before they're quite done. Just like you want one more bite of dessert, like you want to run out of dessert when you still want one more bite, gives you a much better memory of the dessert than if you have one extra bite. Same with this. Same with this. Give students time with hands-on activities. The beginning of the school year is a great time for this. You're giving them habits of doing things with their hands. Coming in February and March, another great opportunity for students to do things with their hands. When it's physical, somehow it's more inviting for students, I think. When they get a little older, give them time to really deeply explore a subject. And this sounds easier than it actually is. So give them time to really explore a subject that they're interested in. In high school, my students always write a research paper, and their advice to students that come after them is, you'd better like the subject a lot before you start, because you're going to be sick and tired of it by the time you're done, because you got to read so much about it. But I wish that I could make them go one step further, because there is a point in time when you get really sick of a subject, and then you cross this breaking point, and then it gets really interesting again. And if we can give our students the time to get past that point of frustration and get back to where it's really interesting, where they're really deeply exploring a subject, that is when learning becomes fun. When students are invited to be involved in their own learning, their curiosity can flourish. When students are given activities and challenges that invite them to further exploration, their learning can flourish. But again, curiosity is not enough. Just giving students a challenge is not enough. I also enjoy Sudokus. We get a magazine, a weekly magazine that has a Sudoku in it. And I'm not very good at them, okay? I'll just put that out. I'm not very good at Sudokus. I enjoy them. They rate the Sudokus by how hard they are. If it says super hard, I don't even start. Why? Because I know that I'm going to get frustrated, and I'm eventually going to have to quit because I can't solve it, okay? Maybe some of you can give me tips and strategies for doing that. In the same way, inviting our students to explore, that's good, but we also have to give them success along the way. So, one of the things I want to do for my students is I want them to be able to do their own independent science report, their own independent science project, and write a really good report about it. So I have these great ideas of what I'd like them to do. But if I just throw them into that and say, this is what you're going to do, and I don't scaffold along the way, I don't build them up to it, they're going to get frustrated. And frustration kills curiosity. So I'm saying that we need to take time to develop their observation skills. We need to give them hands-on activities. We need to get them involved in their own learning process or their own learning. We need to have a vision for them to be curious about the world around them, but we need to build them up to it. When you achieve success, what happens inside your brain is that there's a little dose of dopamine gets released. And when that happens, that's a reward that you seek again. So going back to my example, this intricate identity in trigonometry, if students have been built up to it, they can see this as a puzzle, and some do. But if they don't have the proper background, it's just confusing, and they're not going to be curious anymore. So what should I have done? They need to know it to pass the test. What do I do? What if, instead of walking them through all these intricate steps, I just ask them what they know, and we take a little longer, but I have students involved in the process? What if, before doing all of that, I check and make sure that they actually understand all the background material needed? What if I put a couple of trig identities on the board ahead of time just to make sure that they have those in hand? In other words, what if I build them up to seeing these math problems the way I do? Now, that's up here. That's 11th graders. I don't know what that means for first graders. I have like 2 minutes. I'm just going to ask you, how does this work in like first grade, third grade, fifth grade? Help me out. So getting other students involved can give them some of that background as well. And also, if that student happens to be a really curious one, curiosity is catching. Good. Thank you. Can you rephrase your question? I'm not sure I followed it.
So instead of waiting until the student exposes their frustration, which comes as a result of not being built up to it, do we need to question them ahead of time so that we know how to build that?
Yeah, certainly. One of the things we need to do is we need to be paying attention to where our students are. And, sorry, I'm going to throw a big term out. Zone of proximal development is a term we need to be teaching. So if you think about the student's knowledge as being kind of like an island. The zone of proximal development is the beach on the island where you can kind of extend things. It's the area of knowledge in which they can learn. If I'm trying to teach calculus to third graders, I don't care how curious they are, they're not going to follow me, right? If I'm trying to teach addition facts to 12th graders, they're going to be bored no matter how curious they are, because that's well within the island, right? So that's part of us being good teachers, is recognizing where their zone of proximal development is. It's a great question. Thank you. I believe that our schools should be places where curiosity flourishes. I believe that our students ought to learn in our schools, but more importantly, they ought to learn to love learning. Our schools ought to be places where we as teachers and they as students together can enjoy the process. And when that happens, no longer will it be said that curiosity has to survive formal education. Rather, curiosity survives longer because of formal education. I should say that it flourishes in formal education. And if that is true, then indeed knowledge will grow from more to more. And more reverence will be built in us. And then the mind and soul together will make one music as before, but vaster.
This recording and many others are available through Christian Learning Resource, the campus bookstore at Faith Builders. Order online at www.christianlearning.org or call 877-222-4769.